TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Andy Kimbrell, Genetic Engineering and the Ownership of Life. Genetically engineered food concerns us in the most intimate way. There's an old saying that we are what we eat. Well, we are already eating engineered food every day, and we have no choice. These foods are not labeled. The U.S., unlike any other industrialized country, has already converted much of the soy and corn crops. 40% of the corn and 60% of the soy grown in the U.S. is already genetically engineered. Andy Kimbrell is the director of the International Center for Technology Assessment, Washington, D.C., and the author of The Human Body Shop, a book on the engineering and marketing of life. In this talk, Kimbrell explains how genetic engineering is done and why it can be dangerous, both to our health and the environment. Kimbrell is part of a growing movement that questions and opposes current practices of genetic engineering, demanding a moratorium on transgenic experiments and changes to the permanent genetic code of all creatures. This talk builds up to the profound ethical question, whether life can be owned and manipulated, says Kimbrell, may be the most important and awe-inspiring decision humanity has ever had to take. Here's Andy Kimbrell.
The entire industrial age was really the age of physics. It was the age when fire technologies, pyrotechnologies, built the great machines of the industrial age, fossil fuels, the melding of the ores of the earth to create the great machines, and in many ways terrifying machines of the industrial age. But I think we've now added to that pyrotechnology really the age of biotechnology. And just as our ancestors did take those fuels and ores and meld them, we are now taking the very building blocks of life, taking the genetic building blocks of life, and creating new products with them. And we're using the same engineering techniques they used to build the industrial machines, we're now using with living organisms, from microbes through man. It is an astounding, to say the least, attempt. And I think that the decision whether we become co-authors of evolution, whether you actually are going to mix and match the genetic makeup of the entire living kingdom for profit, for efficiency, for gain, is one of the most important that we have to face. And I think one of the great advantages that I've seen of somebody who's been monitoring this revolution with great concern for 20 years is that now that this engineering has invaded our foods, it's hit a level where almost everyone can understand it. You know, my first lawsuits, we were dealing with microbes like Pseudomonas syringae or Pseudomonas fluorescens. It was really hard to get people really involved. I mean, incredibly important issues. But when it's in your food, I think now when people see it with cloning and some of the human genetic engineering issues, I think people are becoming involved. And it's very, very important that we see the food issue, I hope, as part of this larger issue of the genetic engineering of the world. Over the last 30 years, it became very apparent to me that technology as we have it is not necessarily compatible with life. As we look at global warming, certainly as we went through the nuclear revolution and go through the chemical revolutions, it's very clear that we're destroying life at an alarming rate and that our technologies, while offering us enormous conveniences, do not seem to comport with life. And about 20 years ago, I had great hope with the great inspiration of men like Ted Rozak and Schumacher and so many wonderful prophets that we would devolve technology so it better fit with living systems. And I think one of the terrifying aspects of biotechnology is that it is going about this exactly the other way, is decided to try and engineer life so that it better fits our technologies. I saw a TV show the other day talking about global warming. They said, yes, we now believe it'll happen, but we believe with genetic engineering, we will be able to engineer plants and even humans to withstand the new realities of global warming. So it is a rather awe-inspiring, but to me terrifying prospect. We don't want to genetically engineer workers so that they can work in carcinogenic workplaces. We want to change those workplaces. We don't want to engineer people to fit into our stereotypes. We want to change our discriminatory attitudes and prejudices and not change the people. So as a larger context, as we got into this discussion, I wanted to share that with you, that this is part of a much larger process. And as hard as we should fight and we need to fight on this food issue, it is part of a much greater number of issues that include the very future of ourselves and our children. With genetic engineering, one of the things that the industry loves to talk about is that there's nothing new here, right? Each and every one of you, when you're going to be in a forum arguing this issue with an industry spokesperson, they go, hold on, relax, don't listen to Kimbrell and all the weirdos. This stuff is just fine. It's traditional breeding. We've been doing this for a very long time. I call it the beer and yeast argument, right? You got beer, you got yeast, what are you afraid of? Well, first of all, you might want to point out to them that every one of these foods is patented. So in front of the Patent and Trademark Office, they said, everything is new here. We have created something never seen before on the face of the earth. So it has to be patented. Meanwhile, they're telling the public that it is not new. But what they also don't do, and what I'd like to do with you right now, is to share with you, and I'm sure many of you know this, but for those that don't, exactly what we're talking about here with genetically engineered foods. We are talking about engineering at the cellular level. We are not talking about traditional breeding. Take, for example, a patented tomato that was patented, and this is a tomato that has a flounder gene in it. And they have this flounder gene in the tomato so that it can be stored at lower temperatures, frozen, for very long periods of time. Just what we want with our tomatoes. And this is how they do this. They actually take the flounder gene and they put it into, obviously, cells of tomatoes. But in order to do that, they have to invade the cell. Well, what's the best way to invade a cell? A virus or a bacteria. So, unfortunately, it happens with us too often when we get sick, right? So they attach an agrobacterial vector, in the case of animals, a viral vector, to the gene they want to get in there, right? And it goes into the cell. It invades the cell. But guess what the cell does? Right, it fights it. Rejects it just like you'd reject any kind of foreign organ in your system. So guess what they do? They put in this case, viral promoters. In the case of virtually every food that I know of, a cauliflower mosaic virus promoter. It helps promote the activity of this new cassette, this genetic cassette, which is what they call it, kind of cute, in the cell. But they also don't know whether it's in there. So they attach to it a kanamycin, or now it's ampicillin, antibiotic marker. So later on they can take tissue culture, they can flood it with a E. coli bacteria, they can tell by the reaction that gene actually got in there because it's attached to the antibiotic. All right, so this is what's going on in the cellular level. Now, if you think of a cell, and every biologist will tell you this, and many of you out there are biologists, I'm sure you know this, a cell is its own ecosystem. So this is the invasion that they are doing at the cellular level, this genetic cassette. You've got a vector that invades, a genetic construct, totally foreign, that's put in there, viral promoters that try and promote its activity in that cell, and antibiotics put in there so they can be marker system. This is what's going into these foods at the cellular level. Don't let anybody tell you that this is nothing new. This is a remarkably new engineering of life, engineering of food. Never happened before. None of this has ever happened to our food before. Completely new. Additionally, I don't think they could ever point out to you an instance in nature where a flounder mated with a tomato. That's the easy way out of that argument, if they ask. You can also point out that USDA is taking human genes and putting them into pigs, and that they've taken firefly genes and put them into tobacco plants. And a lot of the images of those things naturally mating are very offensive, so I think, you know, that's a very easy way to handle that. So what happens? Are there some issues with this, aside the fact that it's new? The answer is yes. When we got that discovery that I was telling you about from our 1998 lawsuit, FDA scientists were extremely concerned about what this did to a food at the cellular level. They call it mutagenesis instability, because they don't know where it's going in that cell. They don't have any predictability. And even if they had that precision of knowing where this construct is going in the cell, which they don't know enough yet about the host organism, the tomato, to know that this would be a safe spot for it. So they said this process could easily take a safe food and make it toxic. And they pointed out to the amino acid L-tryptophan that was used as a food supplement, completely safe until a Japanese company named Showa Denko genetically engineered it, then it caused dozens of deaths and thousands of illnesses. This is the FDA saying. This isn't me. This is the FDA talking now. So they said we need long-term toxicological tests to make sure that we do not have toxic effects, that this does not release, trigger in the cell something that's toxic. And since we don't have any, as of yet, and they can do this in the future, but as of yet, any precision of insertion, each insertion essentially creates a new organism and a new threat. Now, they're also concerned about the allergenic reaction, right? You probably heard the fact that there was a food, a soybean, that had a Brazil nut gene in it. And they found out, at the last minute, by the way, that that Brazil nut gene did bring with it allergenicity into the soybeans. So in other words, people who ate the soybeans who were allergic to Brazil nuts had the allergic reaction. So if you don't know what's in the food, for instance, if you have a problem with fish, you eat a tomato, you don't usually assume that a tomato has a flounder gene in it. It doesn't have gills, it's not swimming in the supermarket, right? But they also said, since the purpose of this new genetic material is to create new proteins, many proteins that we have no idea of what they've been before, these new proteins could cause allergy reactions. FDA's own scientists. Then they said, of course, and this is obvious to probably all of you, that because this is such a revolution at the cellular level, it could lower nutrition. And additionally, since so many of these new contracts were made in order to extend shelf life, they were particularly concerned about the nutrition question. And finally, and most obviously for them, antibiotics. Why in the world are we going to have yet another way to get antibiotics into the human system where it could create bugs that are resistant, particularly to kanamycin and ampicillin, two very valuable antibiotics? By the way, the British Medical Association last year called for the complete banning of this technology because of this antibiotic resistance problem. And recently at the Codex meetings in Japan, every nation except the United States agreed that this had to be banned. Sometimes it's great to be American, isn't it? All right, so those were the concerns of FDA's own scientists. I mean, you can imagine us, you know, in our law office going through this stuff. We had no idea that the FDA's own scientists had realized these extraordinary dangers and recommended these long-term tests. But then we traced what happened when their reports went upstairs at the FDA. This is in 1992. Those reports were ignored. And we have angry letters. You can get on our website, which I'll give you later, and you can read this stuff. It's amazing. It turns out that the Deputy Commissioner for Food Policy at the FDA in 1992, who was going to either demand testing and labeling of these foods or was just going to let them on the market without anything, was a guy named Michael Taylor. I knew Michael Taylor because I'd done several litigations against him. He was the big guy at King & Spalding, Monsanto's lawyer at King & Spalding. A year before, he had written the industry's regulation concept for genetically engineered food, which, guess what? No labeling, no testing, no regulation. Same as any other food. He then revolved into the FDA as Deputy Commissioner for Food Policy, and he was the one. This is the guy who wrote up this policy, who rejected his own scientists' advice, and why for the last 7 years we've had absolutely no regulation of genetically engineered foods by the FDA. A complete voluntary system with no mandatory testing of labeling of any sort. What you really have is a corporate coup d'etat of the agency at that point, which is, of course, one of the many reasons why we sued them. Now, I think what makes this particularly tragic is that we have to remember that one of the major crops that's being genetically engineered, of course, is soy. And one of the major consumers of soy are infants, through soy formula. So if there is one part of our population that you do not want to be the guinea pigs for new food technology, it would be your infants. To me, just an amazing regulatory scandal and extraordinary. So those are the human health impacts. There has been a few that are added that you should know about, and one is fairly controversial. Dr. Pushtai in England came up with a study that showed that BT potatoes, and I'll get into that a little bit later what that means, I'm sure most of you know, but I'll go through it a little more slowly, but a genetically engineered potato caused stomach lesions in rats in long-term animal studies and seemed to have a significant effect in lowering their immune response. Now, this study was attacked by the industry. Dr. Pushtai lost his job. Scientists have been on either side of the issue. It was published in Lancet, in a peer-reviewed science journal. What struck me was, and again, you can catch this on our website, this is exactly what they reported in the first test of the Calgene tomato. Anybody here remember the Calgene tomato, the flavor saver tomato? Remember that people are now, by the way, Campbell's, we'll talk about them later too, underwrote that. It turned out it didn't save much flavor, and it's been a bomb on the market. It was a terrible tasting thing and didn't work at all. But the flavor saver tomato, when it was first tested, because it was before the 92 policy, so they treated it as a food additive, it caused stomach lesions in the animals. And FDA asked for more tests, and they said they saw a lowering of immune response. Now, the English government is currently doing 3 tests as a follow-up on this, and I'll be very interested to see what they say. So when people say, you know, We have no evidence of any harm. No one's ever said this could ever hurt anybody. Absolutely wrong. You tell them, no, the FDA's own scientists have said it could make safe food toxic. It could have a tremendous allergenic potential for harm. It could lower nutrition and definitely could create antibiotic resistance, and that's the FDA's own scientists. That they were ignored in this corporate coup d'etat does not hide the fact that that was their scientific finding. And actually, the recent National Academy of Science report, no matter how hopelessly compromised it was through corporate influence, even they could not hide this. And in one of their tables, 2.2, they actually go through this this list as something that they are concerned about. All right, so you have these human health risks. What about the environmental risks? Well, one of the most interesting studies that's come out in the last 6 months, I don't know how many people saw it, came out of Purdue University. And there they took tilapia that had been genetically engineered with human growth genes. The idea was to make them really big tilapia. And this, by the way, followed a series of experiments that have done this. The very first was in 1982 by a guy named Ralph Brinster at the University of Pennsylvania. What Ralph did, enterprising guy, he took human growth genes and put them into mice, right? Early embryo stage, because, you know, and sure enough, he got a giant mouse. And I don't know if you may have seen this on Science Magazine, this great picture. You have a normal mouse and its sibling, giant mouse. And it was on all the front pages. And Brinster was heralded at the time. They had a problem, of course, which is after the, you know, the excitement died down, they asked themselves the question, what are you going to do with a really giant mouse? I mean, outside of Halloween. So they immediately decided, let's put these genes into farm animals. And the first one I saw was Dr. Vern Purcell, who did this in USDA with our taxpayer money, by the way. And he tried to put it into pigs. He wanted to create a giant pig with human growth genes. And I went out there, and his experiment did not succeed. The pig I saw, pig number 6707, was cross-eyed, bow-legged, really a tragicomic creation. And I said to him, my Lord, what happened here? And he said, you know, the Wright brothers weren't successful at first either. I tried to explain to him the difference between like an animal and a machine, but I'm not sure I was getting through at all to this guy. I don't think this was working for him. So anyway, now they're trying to do this with fish. They're trying to take human growth genes and to create these giant fish, and a couple of companies are doing this with salmon. And by the way, the FDA is currently seeing if they're going to regulate and allow genetically engineered fish into our food supply, and they say they will decide early in 2001. And you'll be happy to know that they are regulating them as new animal drugs, which is a novel idea. So you say, why in the world would they be regulating salmon as new animal drugs? Well, for one reason, all trials of drugs are secret, so we don't know any of what's going on. And for the second reason, you don't need to do environmental review of new animal drugs. So is that a serious problem? Well, according to these Purdue University researchers, yes. What they did was they took 60 of these genetically engineered tilapia, put them into the population, a much larger population, and saw what happened. And it turned out that the female fish were much more attracted to the large genetically engineered fish than the normal fish. They loved the big fish. By the way, this explains why I got almost no dates in high school. But that's a much longer story, and I only have, 50 minutes here to talk about it. But anyway, so they were attracted to the big genetically engineered fish. Well, so far so good, you might say. No problem. Big problem. Turns out that that growth gene changes the physiology of the fish, a little like it did that poor pig I was talking about. So one-third more of their offspring die, one-third of greater mortality in the offspring of the genetically engineered fish. So now we got Darwin on his head, don't we? We have a genetically engineered fish that has an advantage in reproduction, but has one-third greater mortality of offspring. And they said after 40 generations, 60 into a population of 60,000 caused complete extinction. This is Purdue University, independent researchers. So we have here, and this is very important because you may wonder, where in the hell, until very recently, has Sierra Club been on this? Where in the hell is Audubon on this? Where are all the Big Ten on this? They are lost in a very important paradigm, the chemical pollution paradigm. Okay? Very important. We all need to keep fighting that. Most of you are fighting it every day of your lives with what you're doing. Okay? Chemical pollution, right? It's a contamination model of pollution. Right? You take poisons and you put them into air, water, etc. Get into our food, get into our systems. Terribly destructive. But biological pollution, or genetic pollution, is a disease model of pollution. It's a living pollution. We know it through exotics, through the fungi that create chestnut blight or Dutch elm disease, or those killer bees working their way up the East Coast. All right? And biological pollution is very different than chemical pollution. You cannot control it. Once it is released in the environment, it's not even like an oil spill. You can't even put anything around it that would control it. It doesn't dilute over time like some chemical pollution does. It reproduces, it mutates, it disseminates. You cannot stop it. Once these fish are released, there is nothing any of us can do to stop this machine of extinction that these researchers found. Biological pollution. You will hear this. You'll hear people say, biotechnology has the potential to reduce chemical pollution. And a lot of the big enviros bought this. Well, first of all, the USDA just did a study and found that in genetically engineered crops, there was no overall reduction of chemical use. Part of this is because Monsanto, as you all know, has Roundup Ready crops. These are genetically engineered crops that are engineered to resist Roundup. So you can use as much Roundup as you want on them. Right? Usually too much herbicide, you also kill the crop. Not anymore. So that's actually creating an increase in the use of chemicals through genetic engineering. So there's no overall diminishment in chemical pollution, but we have this new threat, this new problem with biological pollution. And this pollution, of course, has an enormous impact on organic farming. Because as the Union of Concerned Scientists and a number of other scientists have shown, when they take BT, you know, which is a natural biopesticide, as you all know, and they genetically engineer that into plants, it's in the plants, in the corn, all the time. Unlike a spray. And what they found is that it often doesn't express itself enough to actually kill the pest. So they munch on a little bit here, munch on a little bit there, but there's not enough expression. So it essentially vaccinates them against BT. EPA has recently, on December 20th, in letters to Monsanto, Novartis, and many others, admitted that this happens. Monsanto and the other people have created these BT crops that are creating resistance to the major pests to BT. Now, it may not be a conspiracy, but the result will be as if it were a conspiracy, because without BT, organic farming is going to be perhaps even fatally undermined. Additionally, what they found is this: the BT pollen had enormous effects on non-target organisms. You read about the monarch butterfly. Jane Ristler and Marty Mellon, you concerned scientists, have now done studies and looked at studies to talk about what it does to soil microbes. And apparently, because, remember, it's in the plants all the time, it's going to be in the soil all the time, very destructive of soil microbes. More genetic pollution. And it reminds me of the very first case that I did in this in 1985. It was here in California. It had to do with the Pseudomonas syringae, which is the frost ban microbe. This is a microbe that creates frost on plants. They engineered it so that strawberries and potatoes could be grown at lower temperatures. And we looked at it. Sure enough, it did seem that strawberries and potatoes could grow at lower temperatures. We had some scientists look at it, and they found out, sure, it does, but it does that even better with pigweed. So you're going to have pigweed growing at incredibly low temperatures. It colonized much better on weeds than it did on plants. Again, exactly what Mark was talking about. The ecosystem in ecology is very, very complicated. The idea that you can do these kind of mechanistic solutions is naive at best and potentially catastrophic, as we've seen with the extinction crisis. So you have all these environmental difficulties. And I think you have very profound ethical issues as well. What right do we have to mix and match the genes of the entire living kingdom? Take human genes and put them into genes. The very physiology of all the plants and animals on the earth. Is there some genetic integrity, some basic integrity that life forms are owed? Certainly it's a question at least we should be asking. And then when we have reduced all of these life forms to manufacturers to be patented under Section 101 of the Patent Act, which is what we've reduced them to, right? Our U.S. Patent Office has declared all these life forms, all the way through mammals, including parts of our own bodies, as machines and manufacturers that are patentable. Very, very profound ethical issues about what we believe about life, what we believe about the integrity of life. But I think with the genetically engineered food issue, we're also looking at a tremendous paradigm shift. There's another issue with this that is very important, because the one thing that we have seen with this non-labeling policy and non-testing policy is that there is a premium in non-genetically engineered foods. Is it going to be possible in a few years to be able to actually have non-genetically engineered crops? It is absolutely shown, government's own studies have shown one after the next, that genetic drift is not only a possibility, it's an inevitability. There is no way, no buffer zone is going to keep the vectors from moving that genetic crop into someone else's crop. It's already happened, it's already cost people money, there's already litigation, it's going to be a major liability issue. And this, to me, is truly terrifying, because it means unless we can stop it, we will not have an alternative in many of these crops. Whether it be squash, whether it be corn, we will simply not have an alternative, because no one is going to be able to segregate in some magical way their crop from the genetic drift and the genetic pollution of the crops around you. And so when people say to me, you're not saying no to genetically engineered crops, are you? I say, oh, I am saying no to genetically engineered crops, because unless somebody can show me some magical way you can get out of the ecological law of genetic drift, it means that we will not have an alternative. And no technology has the right to destroy its alternatives. I think genetic engineering right now is a historic battle in this crossroads of two very different worldviews for our food future. On one hand, you have this old corporate model of artificial, industrialized, mechanized food. In the industrial model, the more inputs, the more mechanized, the better. On the other hand, you have a very new consciousness, a consciousness that rejects that model and sees more natural is better. And it's revolutionized childbirth. This is not just simply in food. We've seen it create the environmental movement, much of the feminist movement, and I don't think they were ready for it. You know, I've talked to these guys, and they'll say, Andy, you know, after a couple of drinks, what in the hell's going on here? Why are people so opposed to this? I said, well, besides the fact that it could kill them and it could destroy the environment and offers them actually no benefits, I have no idea.
That was Andy Kimbrough. He is the director of the International Center for Technology Assessment, Washington, D.C., and the author of The Human Body Shop. He was recorded in Santa Cruz by a friend of TUC Radio's, Bob DeBalt. Next week, you will hear from a Norwegian scientist and farmer, Sigmund Qualøy. He tells the dramatic story of the international travels of invading species, bacteria and insects. They come in the ballast water of ships, on lumber, or in the suitcases of tourists. Removed from the checks and balances of their native environment, they often change their destination forever. You can get this talk with Andy Kimbrough, including Sigmund Qualøy, from TUC Radio for $12. We are listener-supported. Your tape order helps continue our work. For a credit card order, call us anytime, toll-free, at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's P.O. Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.